24 hours until the day 24 hours until the day 24 hours until the day 24 hours.
Hi, this is John Hall. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 Acre.
You can find out about so many local events, like the traditional Irish music session. Every Sunday, there's an open Irish music jam at the Shamrock House in East Durham from 2 to 5 p.m. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org and add your own event to the WGXC community calendar and have it read on the radio at 90.7 FM by going to WGXC.org and clicking on the community calendar.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-eyes into here's-how-you-cans. Visit DedicatedPresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Catherine A. Lady of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM. This program is Bequency, and my name is Mayuko. This is a radio show all about bird people in the Hudson Valley. Bequency invites the local community to be inspired by the joy, beauty, and wisdom that bird enthusiasts find in the nature of our neighborhoods. Every episode features an interview with local bird people, plus sounds made by birds and humans inspired by birds. For today's show, I spoke with Anne Bloomfield, a field biologist who specializes in birds. Anne is the manager of the Applied Farmscape Ecology Program at Hudson Valley Farm Hub in Ulster County. Anne will tell us about the American Kestrel Habitat Management Project, which developed strategies to empower hop farmers to incorporate bird-friendly practices. American Kestrel, by the way, is North America's smallest falcon and is frequently observed on farms in our area here in the Hudson Valley. Anne will also share wisdom on optimism in environmental work, and how each one of us can bring our knowledge and expertise to the table, overcoming differences to get where we need to go. Perfect interview to listen to on this Earth Day 2023. And coming up later is a mini interview I did with Mark D. Day, the president of John Burroughs Natural History Society, and he will tell us all about their upcoming bird events in Ulster County, So stay tuned for that. And so now let's listen to the first half of my interview with Anne Bloomfield. Thanks for tuning in. This is Big One C on WJXC.
Well, thank you for taking time to speak with me today. Could you briefly introduce yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm Anne Bloomfield. I'm originally from Albany County, New York, about an hour and a half north of here. My background's in wildlife biology with a focus on birds. I also enjoy hunting, fishing. I really enjoy raising chickens at home and gardening. But yeah, as far as my work here, I'm the Applied Farmscape Ecology Program Manager here at the Hudson Valley Farm Hub.
And could you tell us what the Hudson Valley Farm Hub is?
Yeah, the Farm Hub is a education and demonstration farm. It's about 1,600 acres located in the Hurley Flats in Ulster County. And we could spend probably a whole show just talking about that one question, but I'll say quickly that, yeah, we have five program areas at the farm: language justice, agronomic research and demonstration, ag education and training, food access, and then the Applied Farmscape Ecology Program, which my colleague Teresa Dorado and I run. And we do about 35 acres of mixed vegetables, and then about 1 to 200 acres each of grain, corn, soybeans, dried beans, and small grains. And yeah, we transitioned from a multi-generation conventional sweet corn operation to an organic diversified operation. And yeah, next year will be our 10-year anniversary as the Hudson Valley Farm Hub here in Hurley.
It took me a little while to understand the bigger picture of the operation, and I still don't think I fully understand it. But that kestrel habitat management in the hop field, the one of the case studies you posted on your website, mm-hmm. I think it helped me understand, you know, at least understand part of your mission or operation. And so I wanted to ask you about that particular project. I thought it would be helpful for the listeners who don't have much knowledge in farming like myself. And so kestrels, first of all, the population is declining.
Yeah, in the Northeast and New England, both populations are in a slight decline. And also, interestingly, kestrel body size is decreasing, which there's some theories as to what's causing that, but not a definitive answer.
Yeah, so this one case study is really to help kestrel conservation, I guess is the word.
Yeah. The idea was sort of like, yeah, how can we provide nesting habitat for kestrels? Mm-hmm. Recognizing that, you know, nest cavities alone aren't going to solve larger issues, but they're one tool in the toolbox that puts us in the right direction.
So I want to ask you some super, super basic questions, such as, like, what are hops?
Yeah, it seems a basic question, but I, you know, as, like, a little side information, like, I previously to the Farm Hub was a field biologist. I didn't have a background in agriculture. I had a little horticultural experience working with flowers, and I like to garden at home, but it's been a really important and significant learning experience. So, like, it might seem like a basic question, but when I arrived at the Farm Hub, I didn't know how hops grew. Mm-hmm. So, but now, I will do my best to articulate what I now know.
Sure.
Yeah, hops are, there's so many things to say about hops, but basically they're, a climbing, like, vining plant, and, they have a beautiful, like, citrusy, piney, floral aroma, and they're most commonly known for their use in the bitterness in beer brewing. They also have some medicinal qualities, but that's, like, when people think of hops, they mostly think of beer brewing, and
right.
They can grow, like, 20 feet in a year, and so in order to grow them, you have to have, like, these big poles or posts, and then some sort of twine or line infrastructure that the vines can climb as they're growing. And yeah, they're this bright green color. They're actually closely related to cannabis. So the hops themselves are actually the flower, and they're like these kind of bright green, fragrant, sticky flowers. Yeah.
So this hop field would have already those poles, and that's where the idea came from, that you can install next box for Kestrel.
Yeah, and I can't really move forward with the story without introducing Jane Henson. Jane was growing the hops, and aspiring birder, also a musician. She has like an amazing ear, and when she first started learning bird songs, she would like instantly, you know, hear a bird once and then remember it. And I was like, that is amazing. Like, to this day, I don't think she truly realizes what a gift that is. So, but I wouldn't say Jane is a birder. She's a farmer, also one of my hunting buddies. We hunt turkeys together. But yeah, so Jane was a farmer trainee here at the Farm Hub in our educational program. And at the time, each of the trainees had a crop project, and she was growing hops for her project. It really took her agricultural knowledge and my ecological knowledge together to pull the project off. We were kind of like, you know, farmers already have what they need to get high to grow the hops. They already have, you know, a way to get up to the top of the post to do the work to secure the lines and so on and so forth. So we thought, well, would it make sense in the Northeast for people to put Kestrel boxes in a hop yard to provide? I should also mention Kestrels are cavity nesters. So the nest box kind of looks like what you would think of like a bluebird house would look like, but bigger. So yeah, we thought, can't we put nest boxes at the top of hop poles and provide nesting habitat? But there were a lot of other questions, like, you know, what activities happen in the hop yard, and are those going to cause disturbance at the wrong time? Any organic pesticides that are applied, are those going to impact the kestrels? Is that going to be at the wrong time? So, like, when is harvest time? There are all these questions that we had to troubleshoot before we could push the project forward. So we talked with toxicologists about pesticides. We sat down and had meetings about the timing of activities because, you know, kestrels, they're nesting now and they're going to go through May, June. So we had to make sure, like, is there going to be a lot of disturbance during that time? So we figured all that out, kind of like crossed the T's and dotted the I's and said, let's try to do this. And
so the idea for this kestrel habitat management project is that really, if you're growing hops, you already have this structure.
Right.
And you can just operate in a more bird-friendly farming practice.
Yeah, for growers interested in farming with birds in mind, yeah.
I'm imagining it to be very empowering for whoever already running a, you know, commercial private farming and want to do better in some way. But I think people are so busy and, you know, trying to make what the war ends meet.
How can we find easy ways together that work for everyone? As a wildlife biologist, I wouldn't expect like a commercial grower to sit down with some long management plan and sift through hundreds of pages and then like, you know, figure out the right dimensions for a nest box. And that, you know, it really truly is a team effort of like me understanding, right, like how to grow hops, for example, in this case. And then me bringing like my knowledge to the table of like, well, here's the right dimensions for the nest box. Here's the times you want to avoid disturbance. And I find that in my writing, this comes up over and over. Like I'll be writing a piece for like our newsletter or whatever it might be. And somehow my conclusion always circles around, yeah, this idea of like people bringing their own knowledge to the table and coming up with solutions together. And it's one of the most powerful things about working here, because as a wildlife biologist prior to here, like a good example is grassland breeding birds like bobolinks nesting in hay fields. The kind of like textbook wildlife biologist reply might be, and bobolinks nest on the ground often in hay fields, might be, you know, don't mow your hay field until after July or August. That's a non-starter for farmers, because a lot of farmers, especially dairy farmers who need high nutrient hay are haying in like May and June, right when the bobolinks are nesting. And so, you know, the farmer might say, well, I can't wait until July or August. By that point, the nutrient quality of the hay has started to decline.
Right.
And then the biologist might say, well, but the bobolinks are nesting then. So, so yeah, I guess prior to Farm Hub, I sort of worked in these circles where there was like tension between some of these strategies. But yeah, I guess the further I get along in my career, it's clear that we can't operate that way. We all have to like come to the table with our wisdom. And like, I'm not a farmer, and I don't pretend to be, but I need to do learning enough so that I can get to the point to understand like where those pinch points are and like how we can work together to find.
Right.
It's hard. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Like,
yeah,
it's not always easy.
I think even for consumers too, people have, you know, a lot of things going on in their lives. So sometimes to do the right thing is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
But when there's a specific plans or steps or one action that you can do, it's better than no action to take that one simple action if you can.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a lot of difference.
Yeah, and like, you know, there's a lot going on here at any given time, and we work towards these goals, whether it's grassland breeding birds in the field here that we're sitting next to, or the kestrels, or our turtle project. We just keep moving forward, and sometimes it's hard and we take a couple steps back and we falter, but then we just regroup. But what's important is we keep moving forward and keep working towards it together. And sometimes it's just incremental steps. And I think that sometimes we want to feel like we can solve these issues overnight. But yeah, it's important to just keep chipping away at it.
Well, we just drove by the hop field and we saw one pair. Luckily for me.
Yeah.
So would there be one nest box all over that field?
Yeah, so when the hop yard was still in the location we drove by, there was just the one nest box, and then we have a second nest box further north of here that is just on a post. It's not associated with like a hop yard or any structures, but yeah, we have two nest boxes now at the Farm Hub. And actually, prior to us having nest boxes, the kestrels would come through, but they wouldn't stay. And at the time, I was talking with a raptor biologist, Zach Smith, and he thought, you know, it's got to be your lack of natural cavities. Like, if we put cavities here, like, the kestrels will stay. And he was absolutely right. Like, the second we put nest boxes up, both of them were occupied, like, the following spring. Which, sometimes it can take time for that to happen, but they really
needed
the
housing.
Yeah, exactly.
I can relate.
Yes.
You know, it just occurred to me. So, Jane, so she's growing hops for a specific brewery?
Mm-hmm, yeah, Arrowwood Brewery and Accord. Mm-hmm. They are a brewery, but they also grow hops on site. And so, yeah, Jane is now managing the hop yard there. And then her farm, transgenerational farm, is right next to that. So, yeah, she's doing a lot of awesome stuff over there. And they actually have bluebird boxes in their hop yard over there at Arrowwood. I think for where the hops are there, they wouldn't get kestrels because of the shape and size of the field. But yeah, that's another idea. You could put bluebird tree swallow boxes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of like microbreweries, seems like trending.
Yeah.
I wonder.
Yeah.
Can they, if they're growing their own hops, like I've been hearing lots about bird-friendly coffee.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard bird-friendly beer just yet.
Well, when Jane and I got the idea, I, you know, went to look for a case study because I thought someone must have done this before, and we couldn't find anything. I mean, there's anyone out there that knows of someone else putting kestrel boxes in hop yards out. I feel like I looked this up and there might be like one other place that looked at it was after we did our project, looked at putting bird boxes in hop yards. But yeah, I mean, if there's other folks out there interested in just putting up a kestrel box and see if they have success, it does take a little bit of like I said, thinking through like pesticide materials and timing of activities. But
if a listener is running a microbrewery in New York State, they can maybe reach out to and ask for like
I can't say I have all the answers because like I said, we didn't get enough years of understanding the disturbance question, but I could definitely point them in the right direction of things to consider, where to get the right kind of box, things like that. So yeah, for sure.
That'll be interesting. I would love to have some local bird-friendly beer.
Well, actually, Noah Perlett, the field that we're next to, the Bobolink project in the research collaborative here at the Farm Hub, he's the lead researcher on that. Mm-hmm. It's not in New York State, but he has a relationship with a brewer that does a Bobolink beer.
Oh!
And it's delicious, just as a side note. I think some of the proceeds from the purchase of that beer help to go towards grassland bird conservation work.
Nice.
Yeah. So it could be a thing for kestrels. You never know.
Mm-hmm. Frequency.
You're listening to Bequency on WGXC. If you are just joining me, we are listening to my interview with Anne Bloomfield, a field biologist and manager of the Applied Farmscape Ecology Program at Hudson Valley Farm Hub in Ulster County. We just heard a song titled Robin Jog, which means Lazy Robin it was a song by Welsh folk singer Meredith Evans. And now let's listen to the second half of the interview with Anne. Thank you for tuning in.
Okay, so for the next question then. So I've been reading a book called Birding in the Hudson Valley by Catherine Schneider.
Mm-hmm.
She mentioned that the grasslands of the Hudson Valley are not natural. They exist because humans clear the forests for agriculture. So to learn that the landscape we see here now has been shaped by human activity over centuries, it really made me understand how much influence we actually have as a human being. And I thought the lack of such understanding of our own impact can be a source of short-sighted actions, like, you know, even littering. Like, you don't think you matter, what you do matter. Not knowing how much impact you actually have. Also, I'm thinking maybe relate to how so many people feel they are powerless also, that there's nothing we can do about it. So it was really inspiring to read about the process of your very specific approach and the sense of optimism that you wrote on your article that you felt from working with one another. So I wanted to ask you to speak a little about this optimism and where you get it and how you keep it going.
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's a lot there. I guess I'm reminded of a scene from the book Braiding Sweetgrass. That's a great book if you haven't read it, where the author is asking her students something along the lines of, you know, do you think humans can have a positive impact on the land and I hope I'm getting this right. It's been a while since I read the book, but her students are kind of like, well, no, of course not. Like, look at all of this destruction that humans have caused to the earth, and like how extractive we've been and how damaging. And and then the author is an indigenous person, Robin Wall Kimmerer. She's from, well, she teaches in New York State. Anyway, basically, she's asking her students to imagine a world in which humans do have a good relationship with the land, or even like a beneficial relationship with the land. And she goes on to explain in the book how, you know, humans haven't always been this like extractive, damaging species. Like, there are cultures that still exist and times in our history where people did have a positive impact on the land and a different kind of relationship to the land. And so, yeah, step one is imagining that it's possible. Imagining that it's even possible to think about things differently, and thinking, like, how do we get there? How do we put our wisdom together to, like, get where we need to go? I was just talking to my coworker Andrew Kasner this morning, that works in the field crops team here, and we were talking about how we have some crops planned for some fields here at the Farm Hub, where some of the timing of the activities to grow small grains are not super compatible with the nesting season for turtles. And so, yeah, you could say, like, oh, this is a terrible idea. Like, we can't have this crop here. It's going to be terrible for the turtles. Or, like, there's nothing that we can do. But if instead you kind of, like, flip that narrative and say, like, okay, this is the crop that's going to be here. Like, this is the situation we have. You have your knowledge. I have mine. This is when the turtles are going to be nesting. Like, what can we do? And sometimes it's really hard, like, keeping your optimism going when we live in a world where there's a biodiversity crisis and a climate crisis and all these things, habitat loss. And yeah, I'm not here to pretend that I am optimistic all the time, but I am, like, for the field of study that I'm in, I feel like surprisingly optimistic. And it's a great question. I don't honestly know where it comes from, because a lot of the news about wildlife, especially birds, insect eating birds and grass eating birds, and the declines we're currently seeing in habitat loss is, like, very depressing. But yeah, if we don't have our optimism, like, what do we have? What, we're just gonna stand by and say, like, well, I guess there's nothing we can do? Like, that's terribly depressing. So yeah, all we can do is imagine and believe there's a different way, and work together and fight hard to get there. And I think sometimes we underestimate here at the Farm Hub how just, like, demonstrating how we work together that way seems powerful to people. Like, I think we sometimes don't notice it here until someone notices it and calls it to our attention. But I do believe that even ecologically, that biodiversity is resilience, whether it's ecological biodiversity, or it's diversity of languages or culture or experiences or professions. Like, that makes us more resilient in the face of change. It makes us better suited to overcome challenges. I've been a language learner here at the Farm Hub. I started almost 8 years ago. I'm not fluent in Spanish yet, but I'm getting there. And yeah, just like being able to break down barriers, whether it's like language or your knowledge of farming or any of these things, it's just, at least in the context of ecology, and I feel like anything else, is just so powerful. And if we just stay in our little bubbles and only think about, you know, our experience, we're missing a lot. Like, there's a lot that we're not seeing or hearing when we don't kind of, like, push ourselves to break down some of those barriers. So, yeah. I suppose that's a long answer. I don't know where my optimism comes from, but I think it has something to do with that.
I mean, I think that just means you're doing real work here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So what's the ongoing bird habitat study at the Farm Hub?
Yeah, so in 2016, I started the Farm Hub in 2015, and because it was a private commercial farm for many generations, there wasn't a lot of access for birders. So, like, for the Christmas bird count, there'd be some, like, species lists from along the road here, but there wasn't historic bird data about the interior parts of the farm, and there certainly wasn't habitat use data, and there's a lot of focus on breeding habitat in the world of bird conservation, but there's also, like, overwintering habitat and migratory habitat, and so I was really looking to contribute to the, oh my gosh, I'm so distracted by these robins that are surrounding us right now. I was just like, I'd love to watch a robin for an hour, and now we're surrounded. But yeah, so I wanted to contribute to the body of work around our regional understanding of bird habitat use on farms specifically. Mm-hmm. So with the help of two volunteers, Bob Miller and Dixon Onderdonk and myself, there are 6 bird survey routes throughout the farm, and we survey those every month, year-round, and we record the species that we see, the number, and what habitat they're in. And yeah, there's like a bunch of things that you could use those data for. I did have one idea recently that I haven't shared with anyone, but I thought, well, why don't I just share it on the radio? And that is to, you know, now that I have data going back to 2016, I was thinking of making like an open source data browser called the Agricultural Avian Habitat Use Explorer, where like anyone could just access habitat use information of birds on farms. For example, we have a semi-perennial grain here called Kernza that we're trialing for the Land Institute. There's not really a lot of data on bird use of Kernza, but it's interesting because it's harvested late, mm-hmm. and the bobolinks here like to nest in it, so it's potentially compatible as like a bird friendly crop. So yeah, so one example is that now I have a number of years of basically like a species list of who and when and how often the Kernza gets used by birds. We also have a project, the NOAA Perlet project I mentioned before with the bobolinks. We have tracking devices on those birds, so we can see when they go, where they go, but sometimes it's hard when you're just looking at the bird's position on a map to tell what specific habitat they're using, and it's often agricultural areas, which is interesting. So I thought, yeah, wouldn't it be cool for people doing habitat use work by birds if you really could know like what habitats were in that geographic area and what birds were using them and when. Anyway, there's several other reasons why those data could be useful, but that's kind of the direction I'm hoping to go, is making it open source, publicly available, and then also use that information to potentially create this kind of like a farmer bird guide that's sort of like, here's the quick, easy ways that farmers can incorporate birds into their operations, with those data being a platform to understand like what birds are using which habitats when. Like, for example, at the Farm Hub, later in the summer, we start to see just like a massive influx of indigo buntings in our grain corn. So yeah, I don't think when you're seeing an indigo bunting at like a field edge or a forest opening, like during the breeding season, you're necessarily in your mind imagining that it's going to go to someone's grain cornfield. But that, I mean, that is, it's the case here. We see so many indigo buntings in our grain crops here at the farm. So yeah, there's a lot of really interesting info on birds and their use of on-farm habitats, whether it's during migration or the nesting season or the winter. Yeah.
Okay, that's really great. So I was looking at the, you know, what can I do list on the Farm Hub's website. Mm. I really like that make observations at home about the creatures you see in your backyard. Could you elaborate on the idea behind that suggestion?
Yeah, I like that you put focus on the what can I do list. We kind of like put that together for an event once and people have really like kind of grabbed onto it. And I think it just speaks to, I don't know, people are just like hungry to take action to figure mm-hmm. out how they can help. And so, yeah, that particular recommendation to just spend time observing birds. I mean, there's a couple things there. One, it's just, you know, it's just fun to spend time with and observe things in your backyard. Secondly, I think it's really important that people build empathy and understanding for some of these creatures or beings that are in decline, oftentimes at the hands of human activity. So the more you can kind of put yourself in the, shoes, the uh-huh. shoes of like a bird or any other creature, like the more you can, yeah, understand it and build empathy for it. And I think the field of wildlife biology is moving this direction where we realize that there's like a sociology and a human component to how we look at wildlife, and you can't separate the human component from the wildlife component. They're very interconnected. So it's definitely more of a like philosophical kind of like art or maybe like qualitative way of thinking about wildlife conservation. But I do think that you know, even if you throw some crumbs in your backyard and, like, you watch ants for an hour because the ants come and they're, like, taking your breadcrumbs away. Building empathy for creatures like ants that you might not normally pay much attention to. You know, for some people it's ants, for some people it's birds. What Peter said in the last show you did, like, really resonated with me, where he was kind of like, I didn't really have a choice. I just had this experience with birds and it like gripped me, and I've been looking at them ever since. Like, you never know when for someone it's going to be that moment. And so, yeah, taking the time to spend time with, yeah, ants or birds or whatever it might be is, mm-hmm. I don't know, it shouldn't be underestimated. I think it's really important.
Yeah.
Well, that's the last question. I stopped asking people what their local favorite birds are. I have been asking a question, and Peter, yeah. you heard Peter yeah. saying, like, this is, like, impossible question.
I do actually have a favorite bird.
Oh, tell us about it.
So I'm happy to just, yeah. it's kind of cliche, I feel like, but, yeah, growing up in New York State and spending a lot of time in the North Country, I have to say, hands down, my favorite bird is a common loon. Just like their coloration, and I mean, just hearing a common loon over a still, like, mountain pond in the evening, I think is just one of the best things in the world.
Oh.
So, yeah, I have a definitive favorite bird.
So maybe I'll bring back this question now.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Steph. Thank you for
Well, since Anne said she loved loons, we listened to a field recording from an album titled Voices of the Loon, released by the National Audubon Society in 1980, which is an LP that my friend Ian gave me specifically for this show, Bequency. Thanks, Ian. And a huge thanks to Anne Bloomfield for the wonderful interview. You can find more information on the works of the Hudson Valley Farm Hub at hvfarmhub.org. HV Farm Hub is one word. hvfarmhub.org. I mean, including all the links on the show notes of today's episode, which you can check out at wgxc.org. And also, I posted on bequency.tumblr.com. On this show notes, you can find information about Arrowwood Farms, the farm that Anne was talking about, where Jane now works. Jane, who worked with Anne on this American Kestrel habitat management project. And also the Bobolink beer from Zero Gravity Craft Brewery. This one is in Vermont. They're all in the show notes. And I hope you enjoyed the interview. I kind of started to wonder if it's a good idea to interview birders outdoors because they get distracted by birds, like Anne with American robins surrounding us, and Peter with geese and everything. The last time I interviewed him, Peter is Peter Schoenberger, who, again, I interviewed in the Bequency March episode. It was also a fantastic interview, so I recommend you check it out if you missed it. And so the Peter that people are talking about on this show today is this Peter Schoenberger. Again, you can find all the information, including the link to that past Bequency episodes, at bequency.tumblr.com or wgxc.org. Now we're going to hear Marty Day, the president of John Burroughs Natural History Society, about their upcoming fundraiser event, Big Sit. Stay tuned. Okay, could you introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure. So my name is Mark Day, and you're here because I'm the president of the John Burroughs Natural History Society. Mm-hmm. This is my day job as the caretaker of the Forsyth Nature Center, and supports my habit, which is the study of the natural world and in particular birds.
And could you briefly introduce John Burroughs Natural History Society?
Yes. John Burroughs was a resident of Ulster County, born in neighboring Delaware County. His wisdom, his company, was sought out by, you know, the movers and the shakers of the early 1900s. You know, Edison, Ford, Theodore Roosevelt, you know, all the biggies came to go out and study nature with him, and his writings were mandatory for school children in that time frame, post-Civil War to the early 1900s. There are several organizations that name him. We call them sister organizations. John Burroughs Association, which I say kind of deals more with his literary work and life, and manages and owns the sanctuary. And then us, the Natural History Society, we were formed in 1950. And as SUNY New Paltz kind of came to existence, many of the professors there kind of became pillars of the organization. And we've always kind of delved into more of the nature study and the appreciation of nature. I always like to say they're the smart ones at the association, and we're the bird nerds. But we do a lot of cross-pollination. Actually, Joan Burroughs, John's relative, we'll often read a timely passage when we have a walk at the sanctuary that our membership would lead, be it a bird walk or a wildflower walk, or we even do a moth night there. So it's a nice blend. You know, John Burroughs, I think, has become significant again, because he really preached, you know, look where you step and look above and live in your surroundings. You know, he would talk about, you know, kept track of things like the apple blossoms. He farmed. He raised celery. He had orchards, grapes. So he's a very practical person. And I think, you know, in that time frame, they were going from kind of the old-fashioned farm life, ag life, to a modernized society that Ford and those folks were responsible for. And that was kind of counterintuitive to us as kind of natural beings, creatures. And that's happening again, I think. COVID played into that, recognizing that too. We worked from home, we were in our backyards, and we realized all these birds and other things go through my backyard, and whether it was, we missed it because we were at work, or we just didn't slow down enough to recognize that. We've noticed a dramatic uptick in those who participate in our field trips.
Oh, great.
With new residents to the region that did lead a much faster paced life in the metropolitan area. You know what, they had to, you know.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of the bird nurse, do you want to talk a little bit about this Big Sits event?
Yes, sure, thank you. So John Burroughs Natural History Society does not have a holding, does not have property to maintain. So we do have this fundraiser we started. This will be the 8th year, Big Sit. The idea is that we raise money for good causes that we support, to give, to have fun birding, to have a little bit of a competitive challenge, but then to come June when we have our annual meeting, give it all away, right? Sounds nice, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So on the first Saturday of May, that's become our date, there is a Big Sit that's held globally that's in October. But we figured we'd have ours in May because we'd have the best chance for more species of birds to see and therefore raise more money. So typically, donors pledge per species.
Oh.
And, you know, each sit can have a choice of the...
Different cause.
And, for example, the big sit that I'll be attending, that I'll be at, is at Kingston Point. Wendy Tachi is also going to be there, and Jess Prokop, and we are fundraising for the New York State Breeding Bird Atlas mm-hmm. this year, which Wendy is a regional coordinator. But you know, you spoke with Peter, he's going to raise money to put up wood duck boxes. He's done a ton of boxes at the Vly. We're going to do some over in Dutchess County, spread it around, you know. So we've sent a good bit of money to Annie Martinet, who is Wild Mountain Bird. She does bird rescue and rehabilitation. You name it. We've sent kids to DEC camp, a scholarship. We have Where to Bird in Ulster County panels around that we've installed and paid for. There's one up in the kiosk there. So all kinds of fun things. The Walk Hill Valley Land Trust. And, you know, we've given a whole boatload of money to the grasslands at Shawangunk, or Galeville, as we call it, which is our only wildlife refuge in county.
So there's several locations throughout Ulster County,
yeah.
And the general public, can we visit?
Sure.
And
sure. Well, you know, somebody like Peter, you probably got a feel about how serious he is.
Yes.
He said, I don't want any visitors. I don't want any distractions. he's also very bitter because he hasn't won yet.
He hasn't won the big sit.
Every year. So... we, you know, and where we're located, for example, we're at Kingston Point at the in the Rotary Park, that portion of the park, it's going to be busy regardless. So we kind of deal with passersby, and we have literature to hand out and talk about, and occasionally we'll, you know, get somebody to tag along on a future field trip or even to pledge money. This year, I do want to add too one really cool thing that we're going to do, which is new. We're going to create naturalist backpacks.
Oh.
Which are going to be available at various regional libraries, and you sign it out just as you would a book. And even we're very fortunate to have generous merchants locally too that are going to help us create these at Kenco with the optics, and Chicory Naturalist here in Kingston, which is going to supply all the educational materials for these backpacks. So they'll have adult binoculars, they'll have children's binoculars, they'll have all these like laminated fold-out ID guides for various disciplines, little magnifiers, all kinds of cool stuff in this backpack. And you're just going to check it out, you know, so family can take it out and use it as they would like, and then just return it to the library, or even Chicory Naturalist is going to have some that will be available there. So this is new for us. We're excited about that, doing that. And a couple different sits will be doing that for kind of like their neighborhood library, for example. So it's a big county, bigger than the state of Rhode Island, we like to say. So it's nice that we can kind of spread out and help, you know, many of the municipalities in a small way around the county, you know.
So for listeners to donate, pledge to each cause of their choice, how can we do that?
Thank you. So if they go to jbnhs.org, there is actually a scroll down to PayPal button. You can choose the specific, you can note the specific location that you're going to pledge to. And you, like I said, you could do a flat donation or you can do a pledge per species. That makes it a little more interesting. Not everybody does that, but rather than just saying $25 donation, they'll say 10 cents per species. You know, and it varies from site, you know, from each location. We're fortunate enough to have the river and a little bit of the woods. So you get a diverse selection of birds. So we've typically gotten into the 70s, the species range. So, you know, you take that into consideration. You might not want to pledge $100 per species, you know, but maybe 25 cents or a dollar, some folks will. And some do just give a flat donation, and it's all welcome. And we do two things. We take a cumulative list of all the sit locations. Most years, we have between 8 and 10 locations around the county. So we collectively will have a list of over 100 species of birds. And some folks do that. And they'll just make a donation to John Burroughs and let us, in June when we have our annual meeting, disperse it as we see fit. And we do encourage folks to participate, come along, stop by. Some will even, you know, not come to bird, but bring along a hot cup of Joe in the morning and a couple donuts, you know? Because like our sit, well, I'm about a mile away from where we set up, and if, you know, I'm nervous and can't sleep, I usually get up and go about 2 o'clock in the morning. And then we stay till dark.
So that was Mark's comment on Big Sit, which will take place on Saturday, May 6th. John Burroughs Natural History Society is also hosting the special presentation with Tiffany Kirsten. Tiffany Kirsten is a big ear birding record holder with 726 species and also a sexual assault survivor who works to elevate women birders and the safety of birders. Tiffany has been handing out hundreds of personal safety alarms to women who enjoy the outdoors. This event is happening on Friday, May 26th from 7 to 8 p.m. at the Hudson River Maritime Museum in Kingston. Here's Mark's comments on Tiffany's presentation. Let's take a listen.
So we're excited to meet her. She's going on this tour from Texas all the way up to Maine. And this will be her only visit to the greater metropolitan area, the whole Hudson Valley. She'll stop on the way back in Buffalo. We're excited. We've never really done anything like that. Most of anything we promote is actually in the field. So this is kind of a different thing for us to do. And we're going to have it at the Hudson River Maritime Museum. They have this beautiful barn that they built. That's a real nice venue. And they're very generous with letting us use that site. And it's a Friday night. And, you know, there's so many good restaurants down on the Rondout to go have dinner or drink or dessert afterwards. You know, she's going to do a presentation. We have great door prizes, including a pair of $300 binoculars from Kenco and $100 gift card from Chicory Naturalist. We're going to have Birds and Beans coffee to give away. And we're going to even have some Bicknell's Thrush beer to give away. So we're pretty excited. You know, they're companies that are behind the conservation and environmental concerns. So looking forward to it. I think it's going to be she's not going to really talk so much about her big year, but about the obstacles she's overcome. And this was kind of, what a great way to overcome such obstacles.
Yeah.
Go birding. It's a good escape for all of us, but for her in particular, the hardship she dealt with to come out on the other side a champ, you know? It's really cool. I'm
so
excited.
So people need to make reservations.
Yes. And again, they can visit our website, and you can purchase a ticket there. They're $10 to get in. But like I said, there's a lot of wonderful door prizes, and we're only selling 100 tickets, so good chance to get something. And she's also going to give away some of her alarms to those who first tend to ask her a question. This is the kind of thing we'd like to do more often. And we kind of need to have the reinforcement that something like this is desirable. You know, mm-hmm. It is Memorial Day weekend and it's a Friday night, but you know, it's an hour. Kick off the weekend right, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So, if you are in the area, why not check out these events? For more information, please visit jbnhs.org, which is the initials of John Burroughs Natural History Society, jbnhs.org. This program has been Bequency on WGXC, and I've been Mayuko. And we're going to close today's show with a song called, well, more of a track called Chimney in Bailey by Colorado-based artist and bird enthusiast Lack Leslie, featuring juncos, pygmy nuthatches, red-breasted nuthatch, some faint magpies, house finch, and mountain chickadee. But I don't think I'm going to have time to come back, so I'm going to say goodbye for today. Coming up next here on WGXC is The Countdown featuring Deerhoof and African Head Charge, produced by Tom Rowe. Counting down 10 new sounds, stories, or songs, American Top 40 style. So don't go anywhere. Thank you very much for listening. Bequency is a radio show all about bird people in the Hudson Valley and airs every fourth Saturday of the month. So the next episode will be on May 27th, so I hope to have your ears again next time. Thanks again. Have a great weekend.